Delba pointed out. The barge is almost full. We'll be taking this load up Ocean Parkway soon, drop the sand there at the new beach. It seems like it could get a lot fuller, Roberto said. True, Idelba said. If we were headed out to sea, we could carry more, but as it is, we go up canals to the high tide mark and dump it there as high as we can go, and then bulldozers will come and spread it at low tide, so we can't ride too deep.
Where are you dumping it? Vlade asked.
Between Avenue J and Foster Avenue these days. They tore out the ruins and bulldozed the ground. Half our sand will end up just below the low tide line, half just above. That's the plan, anyway. Spread the sand out and hope to get some dunes at the high tide mark and some sandbars just below the low tide mark. Those are important for catching the malm and giving the ecosystem a chance to grow. It's a big project, beach building. Moving sand is just part of it. In some ways, it's the easy part, although it isn't that easy.
What if sea level rises again? Stefan asked.
Idelba shrugged. I guess they move the beach again. Or not. Meanwhile, we have to act like we know what we're doing, right?
Vlade squinted at the sun. He had almost forgotten how Idelba said things.
Can we go up with you and see the new beach? Roberto asked.
You can, but it might take too long for today. It will take a couple hours to get up Ocean Parkway and then another couple to unload the sand. Maybe you could follow us there on your boat, then leave when you want.
I think we'll have to do that some other time, Vlade said, or else we won't get back to Manhattan by dinner. So let's tell you what we came out here for, and you can get on with your day, and we can go back home.
Idelba nodded. She had still not met Vlade's eye, as far as he could tell. It was making him sad.
Roberto said, You have to promise to keep this a secret.
Okay, Idelba said. Now, she glanced at Vlade. I promise. And Vlade knows how well I keep my promises.
Vlade laughed painfully at that, but when the boys looked alarmed, he said, No, I'm just laughing because Idelba surprised me there. She's good for it. She'll keep our secret. That's why I brought you to talk to her.
Okay, then, Roberto said. Stefan and I are doing a little underwater archaeology in the Bronx, and we think we've found a find that we want to dig up, but we've been working with just a diving bell, and we can't do the excavation under it. We tried, but it won't work.
They almost drowned, Vlade added, despite himself.
The boys nodded solemnly.
A diving bell? Idelba said. Are you kidding me? No, it's really cool.
Really crazy, you mean? I'm amazed you're still alive. Did you ever black out?
No.
Headaches?
Well, yeah, some.
No lie. I used to do some of that shit too when I was your age, but I learned better when I blacked out, and I had headaches all the time. Probably lost a lot of brain cells. That's probably why I hung out with Vlade here.
The boys didn't know what to make of this.
Idelba eyed them a while longer. So it's in the Bronx, you say?
They nodded.
It isn't the Hussar, is it?
What?
Roberto protested. He glared at Vlade.
You told her!
Vlade shook his head, and Idelba laughed her short, harsh laugh.
Come on, boys. No one digs up anything in the Bronx but the Hussar. You should know that. How did you decide where to dig?
We have this friend, an old man who studied it. He's got a lot of maps, and he's done research in the archives.
He went to London.
That's right. How did you know?
Because they all go to London. I grew up in Queens, remember?
Well, he went there and read the records in London and saw the big map there and all. And he figured it out, and we went there in our boat and dove with a metal detector, a Gulfier Maximus.
That's a good one, Idelba allowed.
I didn't know you were into this stuff, Vlade observed.
It was before we met.
When you were 10?
Pretty much. I played in the Queen's Intertidal. We did all that water rat stuff. We were the muskrats. I nearly drowned 3 times. Have you guys nearly drowned yet?
They nodded solemnly again. Vlade could see they were developing a crush on Idelba. He could relate and was feeling sadder than ever.
Just last week, Roberto was explaining. I was stuck under the bell, but Stefan got Vlade to come out and save me.
Good for Vlade.
A shadow passed over her face, and for a second she wasn't there with them, and Vlade knew where she was. She took a sharp breath in and said,
So you think you found the hussar?
Yeah, we got a giant hit.
A gold hit?
That's right.
Interesting.
She regarded them, glanced again at Vlade. He couldn't read her expression as she regarded the boys. It had been too long.
Well, I think you're chasing a dream here, boys. But what the hell? We all do. Better than sitting around doing nothing. Now the truth is, I don't have the right equipment to help you just hanging around out here. Mainly, your job is too small for my gear. We would suck your sight to smithereens. What you need is like tweezers compared to this rig here. See what I mean?
Wow,
Stefan said.
We get it, Roberto said. But you must have something for, I don't know, detail work? Don't you do any detail work?
No.
But you know what I mean.
I do. And yes, I can pull together what you need. You got the sight buoyed?
Yes.
Underwater buoy?
Yes.
Good.
Okay.
I'll put together a kit and we'll visit your site one of these days soon and I'll suck whatever you got out in a couple hours at the most. Suck it up and see what you got. It'll be fun. Although you have to prepare yourself to be disappointed, understand? There's been 300 and whatever years of disappointment over this one, and it isn't likely you'll be the ones to end the streak, but we'll suck it up and see what you got.
Wow,
Stefan said again. He and Roberto were both completely smitten. They were not going to remember not to be disappointed, Vlade could see. They would be crushed when they came up with nothing. But what could you do? Idelba gave him a look, a little reproving, but he could see she was thinking the same thing.
You are setting these boys up for a fall, her look said. But what can you do?
That's what happens. Yes, youth, and they were old. And when they were young, they had suffered a blow. A blow so much more crushing than not finding your pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that it was beyond what these boys could conceive, and beyond what they themselves had been able to handle. So, the boys were going to be okay. Everybody was going to be okay compared to Vlade and Idelba. The boys were even some kind of comfort, maybe, some kind of painful comfort. Something like that. Difficult for Vlade to know what Idelba was thinking. She was hard, and he was stunned just to see her again. He had no idea what he was feeling. It was like being slapped in the face. It was like that feeling of blasting out the Narrows into the Atlantic in a small boat, only bigger, stranger.
A Coney Island elephant named Topsy killed an abusive trainer who fed her a lit cigarette, and it was decided she was to be put down. In January 1903, Topsy was electrocuted. 1,500 people gathered to witness the event at Luna Park, and Thomas Edison filmed it, releasing a movie later that year called Electrocuting an Elephant. Electrodes were attached to metal boots strapped to her right foreleg and left hind leg, and 6,600 volts of alternating current were passed through her. It worked.
D. Amelia. Amelia, having retaken control of the assisted migration, spent the next day or two eating and calming down, with just one camera on, and very little commentary. most of it more suited to a cooking show than animal affairs. Her viewers were going to be happy to see she was okay, and they would empathize with her being a bit post-traumatic. Below her, the South Atlantic pulsed to the horizon with a blue that reminded her of the Adriatic. It was a sort of cobalt infused with turquoise, quite a bit bluer than most ocean blues, and its glitter of reflected sunlight was behind her now to the north. They were deep in the southern hemisphere, and to the south, the blue was a darker blue, flecked only by whitecaps. She was already through the roaring 40s, and had come into the flying 50s, and if she wanted to fly into the Weddell Sea, which she did, she was going to have to angle to the west and run the turboprops as hard as she could all the time to get any westness in the screaming 60s. Here, below the tip of South Africa, down where only Patagonia broke up the ceaseless pour of water and wind ever eastward around the globe, there was a natural tendency for the airship to head east for Australia. Pushing against that caused it to tremble all the time. It felt like being in a ship down on those waves. Because there were waves of air, too, and now they were tacking into them, as any craft on this earth must often do. She was still waiting for her support team to give her a final destination for the bears. There was some dispute between their geographers and their marine biologists as to where the bears would have the best chance. The eastern curve of the Antarctic Peninsula, one candidate, had warmed faster and lost a greater percentage of its ice than almost anywhere on the continent. And its winter sea ice grew far out into the Weddell Sea every four-month-long night. And the Weddell Sea was well-stocked with Weddell seals. All this sounded plausible and right to Amelia, so she kept telling Franz to head that way. But there were competing arguments from others in the ecology group that wanted her to head to Princess Astrid Land, on the main body of the continent. Here there would be a steep seacoast and the world's largest colony of Weddell seals, plus an upwelling from the depths that made for a rich life zone, including many penguins. And it had such a good name. A third faction of ecologists apparently thought they should deposit these bears on South Georgia, so Amelia kept the airship on course to pass within sight of that island as she headed south, just in case. This was a much warmer part of the world, not even actually polar, and with much less sea ice, so she judged that the scientists advocating that destination were going to lose the argument. If they were going to defy the natural order so much as to put polar bears in the southern hemisphere, it seemed to behoove them to at least put them in a truly polar region. As the airship passed to the east of South Georgia, which took most of a day, Amelia found herself glad that she had not been directed to drop the polar bears there. The island was huge, steep, and green where it was not covered by snow and ice, or mantled in cloud that whipped over it in a blown cap that reminded her of the jet stream flying madly over the Himalayas. It looked ferocious and very dissimilar to the western shore of Hudson Bay. Surely the Antarctic Peninsula would make a better new home for her bears, who seemed to be settled down again, back in their quarters. Their breakout and subsequent fast, not to mention the upending of the airship and what had sounded like some pretty hard falls, had perhaps subdued them and made them happier to accept their lot. Several of them had been repeat offenders in Churchill and had spent multiple stints in the bear jail there, so their current confinement was probably not in itself what had disturbed them, so much as the airship's palpable sense of movement, certainly unsettling to any bear that had never flown before. Whatever explained their earlier restlessness, they were now pretty calm in their quarters, and almost all of them had crossed in front of the X-ray machine, and enough images of their skeletons had been assembled to reassure their doctors that there were no broken bones among them. All was well. 2 days after passing South Georgia, they were flying in toward the east side of the Antarctic Peninsula. The sea was covered with broken plates of sea ice and much taller chunks of glacial ice, often a creamy blue or green in color, rearing toward the sky in odd melted shapes. On both the sea ice and the horizontal parts of the icebergs lay scores, even hundreds, of Weddell seals. Amelia brought the airship down for a closer look and better images for her show. And from that level, they could see streaks of blood on the ice, placental blood for the most part. Many of the female Weddell seals, looking like slugs laid out on a sheet of white paper, had recently given birth, and smaller offspring, but not that much smaller, were attached to them, nursing away. It was a peaceful, and one might say, bucolic scene. "Wow! Check it out!" Amelia said to her audience. "I suppose it's a bit of a bummer for these seals, us introducing a predator they've never encountered before, but, you know, the bears are going to love it. And these seals are getting eaten all the time by orcas. And I think tiger sharks or something like that. Oh, sorry, leopard seals. I wonder if the bears will be able to eat leopard seals too. That might be quite a showdown. I guess we'll find out. We'll be leaving behind the usual array of cameras, and it will be really interesting to see what happens. A new thing in history. Polar bears and penguins in the same environment. Kind of amazing when you think about it." As the airship approached the coast, Amelia wondered aloud if they were going to be able to tell where sea ice ended and snow on land began. Everything ahead looked white, except for some black cliffs farther inland. But as they hummed south and west, she saw it was going to be easy. There were black sea cliffs along part of the shore, and above them, the snow was a different shade of white. Creamier somehow, and rising steeply to black peaks inland. Offshore, the sea ice was much broken, leaving lots of the lanes of black water that polar seafarers called leads. As they floated over these, Amelia looked down and squealed. There, underneath them, was a pod of orcas, just a bit blacker than the water itself, with white flashings on their sides, only visible when they arched slightly up and out of the water. A flotilla, possibly 30 of them. Oh, a pod. "Dang," Amelia said. "Hope we don't fall in the water." Not that I would want to anyway. "Has anyone noticed how black that water is? I mean, look at it. The sky is blue, and I thought the color of the ocean was basically a reflection of the sky. But this water looks black. I mean, really black. I hope it's coming across in the images. You'll see what I mean. I wonder what explains that." Her studio people got on pretty quickly to say that it was hypothesized that the Antarctic Ocean looked black because the bottom was very deep, even close inshore. Also, there were no minerals or organic material in it, so one was seeing very far into the water, down to where no sunlight penetrated. So one was seeing down to the blackness of the ocean depths. "Oh my God, that's just so trippy," Amelia exclaimed. This was one of her signature exclamations, controversial back in the studio, as being either a cloying old-fashioned cliché or else an endearing Amelia-ism. But in any case, Amelia couldn't help it. It was just what she felt. Black ocean under blue skies. So trippy. They weren't in Kansas anymore. Which was another useful phrase, as they were very seldom in Kansas. And indeed, that was just the beginning of it. The closer they got to the peninsula itself, the bigger and wilder it appeared. The cliffs and exposed peaks were far blacker than the ocean, while the snow was painfully white, and lying on everything like a meringue. The foot of the cliff was coated with a white filigree that looked as if waves had broken there and then frozen instantly. Apparently, this was actually the result of many waves being dashed into the air, each adding a thin layer of water that then froze to what was already there. These arabesques were a grayer white than the smooth meringue coating the land above the cliffs. Inland, by some difficult-to-determine distance, maybe 10 kilometers, black peaks thrust out of a white and blue surface. The snow there, creamy white. The ice fields blue and shattered in curving patterns of crevasses. These blue patches were the exposed parts of glaciers, even more rare in this world. And yet here, still vast in extent. This was their destination, Amelia was told. She flew inland to get a better look at the black peaks, neck deep in ice. They looked like a line of degraded pyramids. There were horizontal striations of red rock in these black triangles, and the red rock had some holes in it. The black rock is basalt, and the red rock is dolerite, Amelia repeated for her studio feed. She listened to them for a while longer, and then said what they had said, but in her own words, this being her usual method. These peaks are part of the Wegener Range, named after Alfred Wegener, the geologist who pointed out that South America fit into West Africa, which suggested some kind of continental drift must be happening. I always thought that when I was a girl. People laughed at him, but when tectonic plate theory came in, he was vindicated. It was like, duh, trust your eyeballs, people. So I guess it sometimes pays to point out obvious things. I hope so, since I do it all the time, right? Although, I don't know if I'll get a mountain range named after me. The land reared up before them like a black and white photo taken on some colder and spikier planet. These peaks are about 5,000 feet tall, and they're only a few miles in from the coast. The hope is that our polar bears can use the caves in those dolerite layers. They'll be at about the same latitude they were in Canada, so the seasonal light cycle should be about the same. And there are Argentinian and Chileans on this peninsula reintroducing the ancient beech forest on the newly exposed land. Mosses, lichens, trees, and insects. And of course, the sea is absolutely chock full of seals and fish and crabs and all. It's a very rich biome, even though it doesn't look like it. Which, I mean, gosh, actually it looks completely barren. I don't think I would do very well here. But, you know, polar bears are used to getting by in a polar environment. Pretty amazing, really, when you consider that they're mammals just like us. It doesn't look possible that mammals could live down here, does it? Her text reminded her that the Weddell seals were also mammals, which she had to admit was true. Well, mammals can do almost anything. I guess that's what I'm saying, she added. We are simply amazing. Let's always remember that. Having looked at the potential winter dens from as close as the airship could come, Amelia turned back toward the coast. A little bit of katabatic wind pushed them along, and as they floated downslope, the airship rocked and quivered. From behind her in the gondola came the muted low roars of bears in distress. Just hold your horses, Amelia called down the hall. We'll have you down in just a few minutes. And are you going to be surprised? Very quickly, she was over the coastline, and with some shuddering, she was able to turn up into the wind and then descend. This area looked promising. There was an open black lead in the sea ice, clogged with icebergs, then beyond that, more sea ice, and finally open water, black as obsidian. The sea ice was covered with Weddell seals, their pups, and their blood and pee and poop. Meanwhile, the land rose from the sea ice not in cliffs, but in lumpy hills, giving the bears places to hide, to dig dens, to sneak up on the seals, and to sleep. It all looked very promising, at least from a polar bear's perspective. From a human perspective, it looked like the iciest circle of hell. She brought the airship down to the ice, fired anchors like crossbow bolts into the snow, and winched down on them until the gondola was resting on the snow. Now the time had come. She checked the camera array to reassure her techs, and then could not keep herself from gearing up and jumping down onto the snow. After 2 seconds of thinking it wasn't so bad, the cold bit deep into her, and she shouted at the shock of it. Her eyes were pouring tears, which were freezing on her cheeks. Amelia, You can't be out there when the bears are released. I know. I just wanted to get a shot of the outside. We have drones getting those shots. I just wanted to see what it felt like out here. Okay, but go back inside so we can release the bears and get you back in the air. It isn't good for the ship to be tied to the ground in a wind like this. It wasn't that windy, she felt, although what wind there was easily cut through her clothes and rattled her bones. Yikes, it's cold, she cried, and then for the sake of her audience added, Okay, okay, I'll come in, but it's very invigorating out here. The bears are going to love it. Then she climbed the steps back into the little antechamber of the gondola, like an airlock, and with some stumbling, got back inside. It was insanely warm compared to outside. She cheered herself, and when she was back on the bridge, she informed her crew up north and got to the windows on the side, where the door to the bear's enclosure would open. Okay, I'm ready. Let them out. You are the one controlling the door, Amelia. Oh, yeah. Okay, here they go. And she pushed the double buttons that allowed the exterior door of the bear's quarters to open. Between the wind pouring into the door and the bears pouring out, the ship got quite a shaking, and Amelia squealed. There they are! How exciting! Welcome to Antarctica! The big white bears ambled away, four square and capable looking, their fur slightly yellow against the snow, and riffling on the breeze, which they sniffed curiously as they trundled seaward. Not too far offshore, just beyond a narrow black lead, the sea ice was covered with a whole crowd of Weddell seals, with many moms lying around nursing their pups. They looked like giant slugs with cat faces. Alarming, really. And yet they didn't look alarmed by the bears, as why should they? For one thing, the bears were now nearly invisible, such that Amelia only caught glimpses of them, like a crab made of black claws, or a pair of black eyes like the coal eyes of a snowman, glancing back her way and then winking out. For another thing, the seals had never seen polar bears before, and had no reason to suspect their existence. Yikes! I can't even see them anymore! Oh my gosh, those seals are in trouble! Possibly there will have to be some population dynamics shakeout around here. But you know how that goes. Fluctuations of predator and prey follow a pretty clean pattern. The number of predators swings up and down a quarter of a curve after their prey species, in the sine wave on the graph. And to tell the truth, I think there are millions of seals down here. The Antarctic Coastal Life Zone seems to be doing well. Hopefully the polar bears will benefit from that and join the other top predators down here in a happy harmony, a circle of life. For now, let's get some altitude under this baby and see what we can see. She pushed the release button on the anchor bolts, and they were freed by the explosives in their tips. Up flew the assisted migration, skewing on the wind, bounding up and down on itself, and blowing quickly out to sea. She turned it into the wind and had a look below. White shore, black and white leads, white sea ice, black open water, all gleaming brassily in the low sun of midday. Hazy horizon, sky white above it, a milky blue overhead. The six bears were completely invisible. Of course, each of them was tagged with a radio transmitter and a few minicams, so Amelia's viewers would get to see them live their lives on her show. They would join the many other animals she had moved into life zones better able to support them. Amelia's Animals was a very popular spin-off site in the cloud. She was curious herself to see how they did. She was headed home, and almost to the equator, when Nicole appeared on her screen looking upset. What's wrong? Amelia asked. Have you got your bear's feet on? No. Why? She turned it on and got nothing. What happened? We're not sure, but they all went out at once. And in some of them, you could see what looked like an explosion. Here. She tapped away, and then Amelia was looking at the Antarctic Peninsula and the sea ice. Then there was a bright white light and nothing more. Wait, what was that? What was that? We're not sure, but we're getting reports that it was some kind of an explosion. In fact, there's feed coming from someone. The UN? The Bureau of Atomic Scientists? Maybe Israeli intelligence? Anyway, there's also been a statement released to the cloud claiming responsibility from something called the Antarctic Defense League. Oh, that's it. Some kind of small nuclear incident. Something like a small neutron bomb, they're saying. What? Amelia cried. Without planning to, she sat down hard on the floor of the bridge. What the hell? They nuked my polar bears? Maybe. Listen, we're thinking you should head to the nearest city. This seems to be some new level of protest. If it's one of the green purity groups, they may go after you too. Fuck them, Amelia shouted, and started to beat the table leg beside her, then to cry. I can't believe them! No response from Nicole, and Amelia suddenly realized they were still transmitting her response to her audience. She cursed again and killed the feed over Nicole's protest. Then she sat there and cried in earnest. The next day, Amelia stood in front of one of her cameras and turned it on. She had not slept that night, and sometime after the sun had come up, looking like an atomic bomb over the eastern horizon, she had decided she wanted to talk to her people. She had thought it over while eating breakfast, and finally felt she was ready. No contact with her studio. She didn't want to talk to them. Look, she said to the camera. We're in the 6th mass extinction event in Earth's history. We caused it. 50,000 species have gone extinct, and we're in danger of losing most of the amphibians and the mammals and all kinds of birds and fish and reptiles. Insects and plants are doing better only because they're harder to kill off. Mainly, it's just a disaster. A fucking disaster! So we have to nurse the world back to health. We're no good at it, but we have to do it. It will take longer than our lifetimes, but it's the only way forward. So that's what I do. I know my program is only a small part of the process. I know it's only a silly cloud show. I know that. I even know that my own producers keep stringing me out in these little pseudo-emergencies they engineer because they think it adds to our ratings. And I go along with that because I think it might help, even though sometimes it scares me to death. And it's embarrassing, too. But to the extent it gets people thinking about these projects, it's helping the cause. It's part of the larger thing that we have to do. That's how I think of it, and how I would do anything to make it succeed. I would hang naked upside down above a bay of hungry sharks if that would help the cause. And you know I would, because that was one of my most popular episodes. Maybe it's stupid that it has to be that way. Maybe I'm stupid for doing it. But what matters is getting people to pay attention and then to act. So look, it's messy now. There's genetically modified food being grown organically. There's European animals saving the situation in Japan. There are mixes of every possible kind going on. It's a mongrel world. We've been mixing things up for thousands of years now, poisoning some creatures and feeding others and moving everything around. Ever since humans left Africa, we've been doing that. So when people start to get upset about this, when they begin to insist on the purity of some place or some time, it makes me crazy. I can't stand it. It's a mongrel world, and whatever moment they want to hold on to, that was just one moment. It is fucking crazy to hold on to one moment and say, that's the moment that was pure and sacred, and it can only be like that, and I'll kill you if you try to change anything. And you know what? I've met some of these people, because they come to meetings, and they throw things at me. Eggs, tomatoes, rocks. They shout ugly, hateful things. They write even worse things from their hidey holes. I've watched them and listened to them. And they all have more money and time than they really need. And so they go crazy. And they think everyone else is wrong because they aren't as pure as they are. They are crazy. And I hate them. I hate their self-righteousness about their so-called purity. I've seen in person how self-righteous they are. They are so self-righteous. I hate self-righteousness. I hate purity. There is no such thing as purity. It's an idea in the heads of religious fanatics, the kind of people who kill because they are so good and righteous. I hate those people, I do. If any of them are listening right now, then fuck you. I hate you. So now, there's a group claiming to be defending the purity of Antarctica. The last pure place, they call it. The world's national park, they call it. Well, no, it's none of those things. It's the land at the South Pole, a little round continent in an odd position. It's nice, but it's no more pure or sacred than anywhere else. Those are just ideas. It's part of the world. There were beech forests there once. There were dinosaurs and ferns. There were fucking jungles there. There will be again someday. Meanwhile, if that island can serve as a home to keep the polar bears from going extinct, then that's what it should be. So yeah, I hate these fucking murderers. I hope they get caught and thrown in jail and forced to do landscape restoration for the rest of their lives. And if people decide it's best, I'm going to take more polar bears south. And this time, we'll defend them. No one gets to drive the polar bears to extinction just because they've got some crazy idea of purity. It isn't right. Purity my ass. The bears have priority over a creepy, stupid, asshole idea like that.
Languidezza per il caldo. Languidly because of the heat. Vivaldi's instruction for the summer section of his Four Seasons.
E. A citizen. Winter comes barreling down from the Arctic and slams into New York, and suddenly it looks like Warsaw or Moscow or Novosibirsk. The skyscrapers, a portrait in socialist realism, grim and heroic, holding blackly upright against the storm, like pillars between the ground and the scudding low clouds. This curdled gray ceiling rolls south, spitting snow, the needle sleet shooting down through slower snowflakes that swirl down and melt on your glasses, no matter how low you pull your hat. If you have a hat. Many New Yorkers don't bother even in storms. They remain costumed as executives or baristas or USA casuals, but always in costume, usually in black, acting their parts. The only concession to the storms being a long wool greatcoat or a leather jacket without insulation. With many a tough guy and gal still in blue jeans, that most useless pretense of clothing, bad at everything except striking that cigarette smoker's pose, which so many appear to value so much. Yes, New Yorkers more than most regard clothing as semiotics only, signaling toughness or disdain or elegance or seriousness or disregard. All achieving their particular New York look in defiance of the elements, the elements being just a dash between subway and building, and thus they not infrequently die in their doorways while trying to get their keys out of their pockets. Yes, many a dead New Yorker's body has emerged when the snowdrifts melt in spring looking startled and indignant, as if to say, "What gives? How could this be?" Those who survive the storms, despite their nitwit attire, move about the city with their hands thrust deep in their pockets, because only the outdoor workers bother to wear gloves. They keep their bare heads down and hurry from building to building on the hunt for a quick Irish coffee to reanimate their fingers and heat up enough to stop the shivering and fuel the quick trek home. Would take a taxi if they ever took taxis, but they don't, of course. Taxis are for tourists or the fucking executives, or if you've made a dreadful scheduling mistake. The Hudson, on these stormy days, is gray and all chopped by whitecaps trailing long lines of foams. It'll stay that way until it freezes, the clouds low over such a charcoal sky that the white snowflakes stand out sharply overhead. Then are visible tumbling sideways outside every window, also visible as they fall onto the streets and instantly melt. Looking down from your apartment window over the hissing radiator, through the grill work of fire escapes, you see that the trash can lids are the first things to turn white. So for a while, the alleys below are weirdly dotted with white squares and circles. Then the snow chills, the street surface is enough to stick without melting, and everything flat quickly turns white. The city becomes a filigree of vertical blacks and horizontal whites all chopped and mixed together. A Bauhaus abstraction of itself, beautiful even if its citizens never look up to see it, having dressed so stupidly as to make every trip to the corner store a worse journey in the world, with that fatal doorstep result possible for the most foolish or unlucky. Then, after the storms, in the silver brilliance of late winter, the cold can freeze everything, and the canals and rivers become great white floors, and the city is transformed into an ice carving of itself. This magical chilly time breaks up, and all of a sudden, it's spring. All the black trees tippled green, the air clear and delicious as water. You drink the air, stare stunned at the greens. That can last as much as a week, and then you are crushed by the stupendous summer with its miasmatic air, the canal water lukewarm and smelling like roadkill soup. This is what living halfway between the equator and the pole on the east side of a big continent will do. You get the widest possible variance in weather. Crazy shit for day after day, and just as the cold is polar, the heat is tropical. Cholera festers in every swallow of water, gangrene in every scrape. The mosquitoes buzz like the teeny drones of some evil genius determined to wipe out the human race. You beg for winter to return, but it won't. Days then when thunderheads solid as marble rise up until even the super scrapers look small, and the black anvil bottoms of these 70,000-foot marvels dump raindrops fat as dinner plates, the canal surfaces shatter and leap, the air is cool for an hour, and then everything steams up again and returns to the usual fetid asthmatic humidity, the ludicrous criminal humidity, air so hot that asphalt melts and thermals bounce the whole city in rising layers like the air over a barbecue. Then comes September, and the sun tilts to the south. Yes, autumn in New York. The great song of the city and the great season. Not just for the relief from the brutal extremes of winter or summer, but for that glorious slant of the light. That feeling that in certain moments lances in on that tilt. That you had been thinking you were living in a room and suddenly with a view between buildings out to the rivers, a dappled sky overhead, you were struck by the fact that you live on the side of a planet. That the great city is also a great bay on a great world. In those golden moments, even the most hard-bitten citizen, the most oblivious urban creature, perhaps only pausing for a walk sign to turn green, will be pierced by that light and take a deep breath and see the place as if for the first time and feel briefly but deeply what it means to live in a place so strange and gorgeous.
I had to get used to it, but now that I have, nowhere do I feel freer than amid the crowds of New York. You can feel the anguish of solitude here, but not of being crushed. Jean-Paul Sartre.
F. Inspector Jen. Jen sometimes wondered if the patterns she thought she saw caused her to send her people out and make the patterns come into existence. Maybe this was deduction versus induction again. It was so hard to tell which she was doing that she often got the definitions of the two words confused. Idea to evidence, evidence to idea, whatever. Sometimes Claire would come back from her night classes talking about the dialectic, and what she said sounded a bit like Jen's thinking. But Claire also complained that one of the dialectical features of the dialectic was that it could never be pinned down by a definition, but kept shifting from one to another. It was like a traffic light. When you were stopped, it told you to go. When you were going, it told you to slow down and stop, but only for a time, after which it told you to go again. And yet, you were not supposed to have your destination guided by traffic lights at all, but range widely and try to catch things from the side, while also trying to get where you were going. So Jen was baffled as she reflected on these matters, while walking the sky bridges of the drowned city from station to station, from problem to problem. Today she was trying a new way to solve the shortcutters problem from her office to the mayor's residence and reception skyscraper at Columbus Circle. She ambled along in the clear tubes of the graphene spans, switching from knight's moves to bishop's moves, as the 3D grid allowed. A dialectical progress high above the canals of lower Manhattan, which on this morning looked gray and congealed under a low cloud ceiling. Early December, finally getting cold. At 8th, she dropped to the ground and continued up the crowded sidewalks of the avenue, just north of the intertidal. Mayor Estaban was hosting some kind of ceremony for visiting mayors from inland cities, apparently, and Inspector Jen had decided to attend and wave the NYPD flag. This crowd was not Jen's crowd. She would much rather have been submarining with Ellie and her people, having a frank and open exchange of views with the usual gang of water rats and ignoring the various indiscretions in the corners. The politicians and bureaucrats inhabiting the top of the uptown hierarchy, on the other hand, made her feel defensive. They wearied her. And she knew also that many of them were much bigger criminals than her submarine acquaintances. In some cases, she had the evidence of their corruption cached for use at an opportune moment. This was a version of the same judgment she made underwater, that the people in place were better than whoever might replace them. Or she was just waiting for a moment of maximum leverage. Always that waiting made her anxious, as she realized she was making judgment calls that weren't hers to make. In effect, she was herself becoming part of the bad system, the nepotism and corruption, by holding things off the record. But she did it all the time. If she felt that the person in question was doing little harm by being there, such that nailing them might degrade the situation in Lower Manhattan, then she put it in her pocket and waited for a better time. It seemed the best way. And sometimes she caught signs in the files that it had been the NYPD way for a lot longer than she had been alive. NYPD, the great mediator. Because the law was a very human business, any way you looked at it. So here she was, one of the city's most distinguished inspectors, famous downtown and in those places of the cloud, interested in police work. Pressing the flesh and being shown off by the mayor. She had never quite come to terms with this aspect of her job. Her coping method was basically to do film noir. Regard people tightly. Keep a stone face. That manner, plus her height, 6'2" in her thickest shoes, gave her what she needed to be able to hold her own. And sometimes, she was pleased to note, do even more than hold her own. She could intimidate. On occasion, she could play that role pretty hard. Tall, bulky, severe black policewoman Octavia's daughter, indeed. On the other hand, this was New York, where everyone played their part pretty hard, and many of them thought they, too, were in a noir movie, or so it seemed. New York noir, a classic style. Watch out, babe. The mayor had occupied almost all of a new tower at the north end of Columbus Circle, using her own money, but making it the official mayor's reception palace, as well as her private residence. So now Jen clomped up the broad staircase to the mezzanine, moving slowly, like a beat cop with sword dogs. She lifted her chin at acquaintances, said, "Hey," to the functionaries manning the entry and the refreshments table. Then she stood against the wall by the door, sipping bad coffee and staring into the middle distance, as if about to fall asleep on her feet. She took this pose so far that she almost did fall asleep. When the mayor and her retinue swept in, Jen stayed put and watched the throng gather around them and then dissipate, allowing the mayor to make her rounds. Looked like Arnie over there, head of Morningside Realty, a power in the party, chatting with a group from the Cloister Cluster. The people from Denver looked out of place. Galena Esteban was as charismatic as ever. Already at age 45, a retired cloud star and ex-governor of the state of New York. She reminded Jen of Amelia Black in some ways, in that easy assumption of fame. She was like Amelia's Latina older sister, the one who had gotten good grades and even enjoyed studying. 5'5", but heeled to get there. Sweep of brown hair over radiant good looks, her beauty in a broad-faced Native American or mestizo mode. Eyes like lamps. A smile you couldn't quite believe was about you. When she saw Jen, she came immediately to her, as if on a tractor beam to her favorite person in the room, or even the most important person in the room. Jen almost smiled as she acknowledged that, yes, Galena Esteban was the best ever at making people feel good. If you didn't walk away, if you smiled and nodded in response to her operatic overture, you became complicit in her popularity. But in this case, Jen knew it was all an act. Jen had nailed one of Esteban's favorite aides taking kickbacks from an uptown developer. And really, it was obvious from the proximities involved that Esteban had to have known about it. Galena hadn't liked having to accept her aide's hasty resignation and had retaliated with some hammering of Jen's support at police headquarters. Then some disabling blows at their cloud infrastructure, which was ugly revenge indeed. NYPD had been materially harmed. So now the two hated each other. But New York had to be an impressive place for Denver execs to visit, and appearances therefore had to be upheld, or else the cloud would fill with a fog of salacious speculation so thick that they wouldn't be able to see to do their respective jobs. So they made nice. "I didn't know you would be here," Esteban said. "Your people told me to come. Since when has that made a difference?" "What do you mean? I always come when I'm called." Esteban laughed cheerfully at this. People would think they were amusing each other. "I don't think any of my people asked you to be here. Come on, why really?" "Well, now that you mention it, I'm hearing about stuff happening in the intertidal. Unsolicited offers on buildings down there, combined with threats and some sabotage, and some messing with the local scene down there. So I thought I'd check to see if you or your people have heard anything about this. You usually have your finger on the pulse of the city, and people are getting anxious." The mayor turned to Tanganyika John, one of her minions, who had just hurried up to join them and run interference. "Any news about that you know of?" John shrugged. "No." If they knew anything, they wouldn't say. Jen was used to stonewalling, from them and from everyone. And in other situations, she might have undermined their stone wall a little. But this was not the time for that. Esteban extended a bubble of good cheer around her, that it would be impolitic to pop, especially with all the people from Denver there in the room. Jen shrugged back at John, trying to indicate with her stare that she didn't expect any minion help at any time. "It may be only visible underwater," she said, or in city stats. I'll check with my people in real estate transfers and see if they've seen anything. Good idea. Everything okay otherwise? Not really. You know how it is. When real estate worries go up, people get stressed. Meaning, we're all stressed all the time, right? I guess. This time is different, you're saying. It seems like something new is happening. Jen stared at the mayor. It was part of their conflict, each claiming to be closer to the real heartbeat of the city, fighting over which of their angles of vision showed more. There was no way to win this, even if they had sat down and compared notes on it, which they would never do. A formal debate with God impartially judging, not gonna happen. So it was an attitude thing, not at all uncommon among New Yorkers. I know more than you do. I know the level below yours and above yours. I have the secret knowledge, the key to the city's life. No one could ever really win at that. But no one could lose either. Not if they hung tough. Jen did that now, while hoping that Claire had some of her implants in the mayor's office here, watching the minions on hand. Some of these people she would like to have tracked after this reception, to see if her appearance might tip someone into making a move. Someone might feel impelled to go out and make a call, tip a contact, warn someone somewhere. She had to hope for such a move, or else it would just be a case of giving away her interest without any more result than causing involved parties to get more cautious. Well, that too might be trackable. One never knew. She had to put in a bid to start the game. But there was one more thing to try. Olmsted had recently discovered a link between the mayor and Arnie Bleich, the owner of Morningside Realty, who was right there across the room. So you're working with Arnie Bleich on projects downtown? Staubon blinked, processing both the question and the fact that Jen had asked it at a reception like this one. She definitely didn't like it. You mean me, personally? Obviously. No. And now her smile was definitely a fuck you. Excuse me. I've got to say hi to all our visitors here. I have to mingle. Of course. I'll do the same. After that, it was just a matter of staying visible for a while, looking politely ominous, then getting away unobtrusively. Claire's team would be taking it from there. It wasn't much different from visiting Ellie's. Show up and give them a shock. See if any guilty fled where woman pursueth. She surveyed the minions herself, trying to gauge the room. They were very attuned to the mayor's mood, and now they were a little freaked and not looking Jen's way. With a sudden onset of latham lucidity, Jen saw the power structure of the city with X-ray vision, all a-tremble with force fields, like magnetic lines emanating from the gorgeous mayor. Jen had broken the glass over some kind of psychic alarm bell. And now it was ringing. Eventually she left, and as it was late, she called a police cruiser to the floating tide dock at 8th between 35th and 37th. When she got back to her apartment in the Met, she changed clothes, went down to Vlade's basement room, buzzed the door. No answer. So she walked up one flight of stairs to the boathouse office, and there he was. Jen had the impression he spent far more time here than in his room, which was basically just a place to sleep. Like her, in that regard. This office was his living room.
How's it going? He asked.
Pretty well. I'm still nosing around the stuff that happened here. Anything new there?
I'm not sure. The generator wouldn't start, and there was a clog in the sewage line. If there weren't other things going on, I wouldn't think twice about it. But as it is, I don't know.
He looked up into the hung boats high in the boathouse, frowning somberly. Slab shoulders slumped, slab cheeks too. Apprehensive. Which made sense. Even if he had been somehow bought or otherwise won over by the people offering on the building, or the people messing with the building if they weren't the same, He could never count on them keeping their word to him when they took over. More typically, new ownership would hire new management, in which case Vlade would be out of a job. That would represent disaster for him, it seemed to Jen. The building was his clothing and home.